to the lightning round.
Welcome.
Hello, and welcome to the midweek episode of the Dave Kirshner Lightning Round podcast. The midweek show is dedicated to all things preparedness. I wasn't sure I was going to get this show out. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I'm getting over a cold. And as such, we're going to start the show off with a little talk about health. And as most of you know that have been following the podcast or have been listening to the podcast, I've written not only a five-part fictional series where, you know, the Cliff Notes version, I took down the big ag industry in book one. I took away all your money in book two. Book three, I popped off an EMP. And books four and five take place 20 years after that EMP, and when I finished that, I was looking for another avenue to continue writing, and I was taking a lot of notes when I was writing that book series. So each one of those books is over 300 pages, roughly, I think. So that's, you know, 1,500 pages of fiction that had nearly half as many pages of research, whether that was about, you know, nuclear stuff, calling in artillery, or if it was about different types of seeds and ammunition and health. A lot of the health stuff came in parts four and five, keeping large groups of people, refugees, healthy, things like that. So, during the course of all that writing, I had all of these notes, and I wound up writing two nonfiction books shortly after I published part five. The first one that I put out was Home Remedies, Poultices, Salves, and Tinctures, and the other one was Preparing to Prepare, A General Guide to Self-Sufficiency and Preparedness. So, I'm going to look at Home Remedies, Poultices, Salves, and Tinctures right now, because you can hear it in my voice. I feel fine, but I had a head cold, chest congestion, runny nose, things of that nature. So I looked to my own research and my own books and my own past experience to best address that. And what I did starting yesterday was taking a tablespoon of honey and a quarter teaspoon of cinnamon, and you just gulp that down. And I'll tell you what, I woke up this morning and I was like, boop, ba da boop, it's a brand new day. I also, and that information's actually in chapter 10 in the additional information chapter under, surprisingly, cinnamon and honey. Go figure. But my youngest daughter got COVID in January. And one of the things that the doctor told her and us to get her was elderberry. And so we have a bottle of Irwin Naturals Global Wellness ImmunoShield with elderberry. And you take three of these. I mean, these pills are huge. It's like little horse pills, man. You take three of these things with a glass of water and a meal. And the elderberry, what it actually is doing, is helping to reduce and fight off the inflammation of the heart and lungs. But elderberry is also a good ingredient, natural ingredient, to help stave off the effects of cold and flu season. One of the other benefits of elderberry, obviously, is in the name of the product. It helps bolster the immune system, so it helps it fight and ward off, you know, infections and viruses and things of that nature. So, I may sound like crap, but I actually feel pretty good, which is good for me because I got a duck hunting trip this weekend. So I got my buddy flying in on Saturday. And, you know, every time I go see him, he puts me to work. I think I've told you this before. He and his dad have a property business. What do they call it? Land development business. So they go buy these huge tracts of land, and they sit on them for 5 to 10 years, sometimes less. Basically prospecting. You know, they're looking at the political climate. They're looking at the movement of people. They're looking at people, the movement of people in terms of where people are more or less migrating to, instead of living in the high tax counties in North Carolina, like Mecklenburg, which is where Charlotte is, or Wake County, which is Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, and a few other counties. So people don't want to live in those counties because A, the high tax rates, and B, the high crime rates. Because when you live in these bigger towns and bigger cities, not only do your taxes go up, your property values go up, but also your crime rates go up. And they all seem to go hand in hand for some reason. So people want to get the hell out of those counties, and so they buy these tracts of land, and then when they start seeing people moving in their direction, meaning their research was right, and people are migrating out away from these cities, they're willing to trade drive time for peace of mind and security. So they'll sit on these things, and then when they see the population start migrating toward their land, they'll go in and put in a housing development. They won't build the houses per se, but they'll work. They do all of the dirt work, is what he always, my friend Rob always tells me. We do the dirt work, man. So they go in, they clear the land, they cut in the roads, they put in the water, the gas, the sewer, electrical. And then a lot of these homes are on slabs. Up here in Ohio, most everybody has a basement. Down there, not many people have a basement. Basements in North Carolina are kind of an extravagancy, at least in those parts for some reason. I don't know. But so that's what they do. So he's coming up here on Saturday, and I'm going to put him to work. We're going to Grandma's house, and he's going to help me get the last of the fall debris out of all of the beds. You know, pretty easy work. You know, we're raking leaves is what I've got him doing. But when I go see him, he sticks me on a skid steer, or he puts me in a backhoe, and you know, or I'm the guy that has to get in the hole that he just dug. You know, I love it. You know, we go out with chainsaws, whatever. We, you know, if he's clearing land, I'm helping clear land. We're run up to the store and get the crew, you know, a bunch of coffee, or get the crew lunch, or you know, whatever. But I love it. I truly love being outside. I love doing that type of work. But you know, our paths diverged. I went the professional route. His dad took the professional route, meaning he owns the company and he does all of the handshaking and the glad-hatting with, city council to get things approved and what have you. But my buddy Rob, he does all the grunt work. Not to say that he can't run the company one day. He definitely knows how to do it. But you know, it is what it is. So, that's what I got planned for this weekend, but I'm going to record the weekend show before he gets here. And, so we'll have that out. But on Sunday, we're going to hang out, have a breakfast with the family, and then we're going to go up to Cardinal Shooting Center. He wants to get some time in on my Browning pump shotgun because he didn't want to fly with his gun. He didn't want to deal with TSA. So I'm letting him borrow one of mine. And so we're going to go to Cardinal and go pop off some rounds and do some sporting clays and then drive on up to Port Clinton where I found an outfitter, Captain Ken. And he runs a couple boats. He's got a couple captains that work with him. And so we're going to go duck and goose hunting Monday and Tuesday. We've got some other friends coming in just to shoot for the day on Monday. Checking the local weather. You know, if you look at where you're going to hunt, you know, it's going to be in the 30s, lows in the 20s, which is good. It's good duck hunting weather. Cloud cover, the whole bit. But what you actually need to do is you need to look at what the weather looks like the week before 500 miles north of you. Because when you're dealing with migratory birds, you need the cold weather up in Canada to push those birds out of their nesting spots so that they start migrating to their winter habitats down south. So I looked. I zoomed in on the weather.com app, which, don't get me wrong, I'm not promoting them because I think they're a bunch of climate change wonkers and political activists now, but I've zeroed in on a little town up in middle Canada called Fort Severn. It's on an Indian reservation or an Indian lands. And the temperature up there all week long this week, the high was a negative number. Yeah. Like the high today, this episode is actually going out a day late because of family obligations. I got the show started and then, you know, the wife came home, the kid came home, and then, oh, you're feeling better. Great. Let's go do this. And, oh, you're feeling better. Okay, let's do this. And we got to handle that. So anyway, this one's coming out a day late, but, you go check out the weather. You need to check the weather further north because what you're trying to do is gauge, are the birds going to be flying? Is the weather going to be bad, or is it going to be a bluebird day, or is, you know, but at the location where you're shooting. But if you look further north and you see that the week before you're going to go hunt, you know, they got crappy weather, then that's going to make the hunting for you and your location better because the crappy weather further north is going to push the birds, whether that's duck or goose, regardless of the type of duck or goose, but, you know, the species in general. So in Fort Severn, Canada, this week they're expecting highs of -2, -8, -10, with lows down around -20, -15. So that's good for me. The last couple times I've gone hunting with Rob, I met him at their cabin down in Virginia before they sold it just recently, but they had a cabin down in southwestern Virginia near the New River. And, you know, it's tough to get away when you have kids and you have obligations and you know, money's tight and what have you. But we managed to pull this one off. We get down there and sure enough, you know, it's bluebird days and it's just the worst hunting possible. And when I say bluebird day, I'm talking about it was nearly 65 degrees and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. Like we saw the geese and they were flying at several thousand feet. We were not going to hit them. On a different trip, I went all the way down to North Carolina and, you know, it was the only weekend that we could do it because of the age of our kids, the activities, family obligations, etc. I get down there and it is the fullest moon you've ever seen. And I don't know if you know anything about duck hunting or ducks and geese in general, but when there is a full moon, it is like a drunken frat party. What I mean by that is if they can still see by the light of the full moon, they will stay on the river or wherever their food source is. They will stay at that food source and they will just gorge themselves all night long. So in this particular instance, we were down there to go wood duck hunting. And we'd gone stomping out into the swamp. And, you know, we're waiting. We saw four birds all morning leave the roost and head to the river. And then that night, we waited. You know, just thinking, well, we got skunked, right? So we waited. We came back in the evening, waiting for them to come back to the roost. We saw the same four birds. The next morning, well, not even the next morning, after we got back to the house, I was like, dude, we saw the full moon, and it didn't occur to us what had happened. And sure enough, you know, I checked the weather, and I checked the phases of the moon, and I did all that stuff, and it just, I was like, man, you can't, this is just ridiculous. So the next morning, we just went down to the river, and we set up a blind down there, and I mean, there were more ducks and geese down there than we knew what to do with, but it's part of knowing what you're hunting and the habits of that particular animal, whether it's a deer, a moose, an elk, a duck, a goose, you know, whatever, antelope, whatever it is you're hunting. And a lot of this type of information with regard to hunting and knowing where things are located can be found in my book, Preparing to Prepare. So we're going to talk about this for a second, and then we'll go back to the health stuff. In chapter 5 of the book, Preparing to Prepare, there is a section titled Available Food Sources. And it basically explains what I just talked about, meaning you need to know what is around you and what food they like so that you know where to go hunt them. So you're looking for their food source so that you can get your food source. So if you know that, you know, deer like apples, which they do, and you have planted apples, you are likely going to be successful if you hunt near your orchard. If you have a water source on your property, meaning you've used hugel culture, you use swells, you've diverted water into a man-made pond, or you have natural depressions on your land that are seasonal, that hold water except during extreme drought, the animals in your area know this, and they will come to those water sources or those food sources, and you will give yourself a better than fair chance of being successful on the hunt if you understand how your prey functions in the wild and what they're doing. When is their mating season? What do their tracks look like? How do they migrate? You know, all of these things come into play, and I step through some of this, and I give you some of the species that are available in the continental United States, or I should say North America, everything from alligators to wolves. It's on page 105 in the printed book. And then I go on to explain information that pertains to tracking and trapping. So what they are going to be doing in any particular time of year is of extreme importance and relevance. And these are the types of things that you need to know if you're going to try and make a go of it in a self-sufficient lifestyle type of way, even without a societal collapse. If you want to be a homesteader, and, you know, because when my friend and I go hunting, it's not because we necessarily need the meat. We have jobs. We can afford to do this. We're not living a subsistence lifestyle. We're going to eat it. Don't get me wrong. But we're not going out to do it because we have to do it. We're not trying to feed our family. We're giving our family a little extravagance by providing a duck or a goose or a deer. We're, you know, this is not something that I need to go bag three deer every year in order to keep meat in the freezer to keep my family fed. I'm not in that boat, but some people are. And if you are planning or thinking about becoming one of those people that wants to do subsistence, wants to do self-sufficiency, off-grid type stuff, you need to know where the water is, where the food is, because that's where you're going to find your own food. And with that cough, we're going to go back to the health stuff. So I talked about the elderberry and how it kind of helps boost your immune system. One of the other things that is in the book, I don't have a dedicated section to it, because, I mean, if you're looking in the home remedies, poultices, salves, and tinctures book, chapter 4 is a rundown and information pertaining to a list of potential ingredients. Everything from activated charcoal and anise hyssop, amaranth, all the way down to, you know, turmeric, witch hazel, yarrow. But one of the things that I did not cover, and I'm a little upset that I just discovered this, is an ingredient called ashwagandha. And what I have been doing is, basically, I've been noticing that I'm a little more scatterbrained than usual. And part of it is the weather here in Ohio. I was born and raised in the South, and the only time we didn't have blue skies is when it was actually friggin' raining. But when you live in the Midwest, and Ohio in particular, when winter comes, the blue skies are few and far between, whether it's raining or not. Like right now, I'm looking out my window, it's not raining, but we're under a constant cloud cover. And it gets very depressing. And I even noted it in the show notes for one of my episodes where, you know, keep up if you can. Dave kind of bounces all over the place, yada, yada, yada. Well, one of the things that I started doing this week was taking my own advice. I started looking through my book. I was like, there's got to be something that I can do besides getting stuck on Adderall. Is there something that I can do to provide clarity of mind? And as I was going through the book, I found what I was looking for. I knew I had something like it, and it was ashwagandha. So the only reference in poultices, salves, and tinctures for ashwagandha is in the tincture chapter on page 129. It's the ashwagandha leaf tincture, and I've noted that its treatments are stress, anxiety, depression, boost of brain function, lowers blood sugar and cortisol levels. So I'm not currently growing ashwagandha. Ashwagandha. Wakanda. What is this? I'm a Marvel movie. It's Wakanda. But I was in the grocery store the other day, and I happened to be going through the pharmacy area, and I saw a bottle of ashwagandha gummies. And I thought, well, I'm going to try those. So I read the label. I made the mistake, right? So the first day I got it was like mid-afternoon, Monday. And I was like, oh, I'm taking one of those. I want to see if this stuff works because I want to be able to talk about it in my podcast. And the directions say, for adults, take one. It's a vegan gummy. Take one vegan gummy daily, preferably with a meal. Well, I took it mid-afternoon, like 3:30, 4 o'clock. And I'll tell you what, I did not go to sleep that night. I was up until probably 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Because my mind was functioning at a very high level. I was trying to solve numerous problems and numerous things. I was in constant communication with John Jeffers, because we're trying to figure out social media for the Contra Radio Network. And we're bouncing ideas back and forth off each other. And I'm sitting there reviewing information that he sent me. And I'm responding. I'm like, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I'm going 100 miles an hour. So the next day, when I finally did get some sleep, I got about 4 or 5 hours of sleep. I made sure that I took the gummy with my breakfast and not my, you know, early dinner. But the ingredients list lists that each gummy contains 500 milligrams of ashwagandha. And I thought, okay, that's good. That's what we want to see. But then I got curious and I was a little irritated, like I said, because I didn't have information in the book pertaining to ashwagandha. So I just went online just so I could provide the information to you. But basically, ashwagandha is an evergreen shrub that grows in India, the Middle East, and parts of Africa. It has a long history of use in traditional medicine. For hundreds of years, people have used the roots and orange-red fruit of ashwagandha for medicinal purposes. The herb is also known as Indian ginseng or winter cherry. So then I thought, okay, can I grow it? And turns out I can. Ashwagandha grows well in the rainy season in those particular locales, which were India, the Middle East, and parts of Africa. They have a dedicated monsoon season. But it grows well in sandy loam or light red soil, having a pH of 7.5 to 8 with good drainage. Black soils or such heavy soils are suitable for cultivation. It is grown as a late rainy season crop. And then they threw in a word that I don't know if I've ever seen before. K-H-A-R-I-F. Karaf. Late season karaf crop. Okay. But I thought, well, can I grow it here in Ohio? And the answer is yes, because it can be grown up into cold hardiness zone 6. And Ohio, the bulk of Ohio, is in zone 6. There's one spot in almost the middle, kind of northeast of us, that drops to a zone 5, and I know why. Mostly it deals with the topography of that area. But if you're in zone 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you can grow ashwagandha in your garden. It's a perennial, and so you can just keep it. But if you're in zone 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, etc., you have to basically grow it indoors because it's just not going to survive. So now my next step is to try and find ashwagandha seeds so that I can start growing this, so I can make my own teas and I can have ashwagandha tea in the morning. I could, you know, in theory, then go to the point where I'm making my own tincture for that. Now that I know that I can grow that here, that works in my favor. So to make your own tincture of that, you need 2 cups of ashwagandha leaves and vodka. You know, tincture's basically got an alcohol component to it. So what I wrote was, roughly chop the ashwagandha leaves and loosely pack in a pint-sized mason jar. Fill the jar with vodka. Use a wooden spoon to push down any floaters and remove most of the bubbles. Store in a cool, dark place for 4 to 6 weeks. Shake gently on occasion. Strain through a fine mesh cloth into a clean, large-mouth jar, and then squeeze out as much liquid as possible from the leaves. Then you're going to use a funnel and pour the liquid into tincture bottles and store in a cool, dark area. The dosage that I found for this particular recipe said 1/4 teaspoon 3 times a day. It doesn't have the milligrams, unfortunately, but this particular gummy has 500 milligrams, and they say take 1 a day. So by the time my day is done and I've been able to maintain that mental focus, you know, I'm ready for bed, and it's kind of worn off. And so I take another one the next day. That way I'm using a natural product instead of a chemically created one in Adderall. Now, Adderall is being derived from a couple different natural ingredients and sources, but it is a man-made drug, basically. So I'm choosing to stay with a more natural route. I mean, yeah, they're gummies, so they've got syrups and sugars and stuff in there, but, you know, it's minimal. It's basically to just allow it to stay in a gummy state. So that's what I want to talk about today. So we've got medical stuff, and we had some hunting stuff. And, yeah, hey, yay me! So next week's midweek show on preparedness, I'm going to give you an update on how the hunt went. And if there was anything that I would change, anything we could fix, anything that we could address to make the hunt more successful if we don't have a good hunt. So, but we're using a guide service. They know where they're going. We're going to be up on Lake Erie. It should be good weather for duck hunting. And I'm looking forward to it. The funny thing is, I think I mentioned this before. I was supposed to go a few weeks ago and then had to move it because we had a funeral and then a surprise 50th and then a surprise 25th anniversary. And so, you know, I had to move it. So I'm going to be up there this weekend and then I'm turning around and going back up there the next weekend with a different captain, but with the same guide service. So we're going to see. I wanted to kind of compare and contrast the different captains. To see who had a better knowledge base, who was more accommodating, who provided what. So that's kind of my point behind all that. So, but it should be fun. So in addition to that, I did get hold of an article for next week where an author named Rich M. Posted an article up on Ask a Prepper, and it was titled, 3 months of survival food with only $100. The caveat to that is basically, for 3 months, you're eating rice and beans with pan bread with peanut butter. So, it's a limited diet, but you can get all the ingredients for that to last you 3 months for less than $100. So I thought I'd review that with you and then kind of compare and contrast that with what was written in Preparing to Prepare in terms of getting the correct number of servings, getting a good number of calories, at least 1,500 to 2,000 calories a day. Kind of compare and contrast the article with what I've actually gotten written, so to kind of give you a fuller, broader picture of that particular topic. So that's it for today, or for the midweek show, I should say. And I look forward to giving you an update on the duck hunt and a review of this article next week. Take care. God bless. See you next time.
Happy Hunger Games, and may the odds be ever in your favor.